That wasn't my dart that put him to slumber. They looked down at the drow.
My dart, he said.
Why?
Drizzt asked. Jarlaxle wouldn't want him dead, I figured.
Good choice. Let him up, Gwen. When the panther sprang away, Regis moved to offer his hand, but with agility only a dark elf could match, the drow leaped to his feet.
Your name?
Drizzt demanded. The drow hesitated, and Drizzt sighed.
Raylan Jankay, he answered. Of Bregan de Earth?
Braylon nodded.
What will you tell Jarlaxle, then? What would you have me tell him?
Regis whistled sharply, startling them all. When they reflexively turned to the halfling, he motioned rather sheepishly down the road to his pony, which he had just called back. The little round-bellied pinto cantered along, tossing his head as if in complaint, which of course seemed fitting to the others for Regis's mount.
Tell him that I pray he is well.
Drizzt answered and laughed.
Where have you been, Drizzt O'Erden?
Braylon asked.
Jarlaxle has been looking for you for many years.
Drizzt considered it for a moment, then sighed. I needed some rest, apparently.
18 years?
Braylon said skeptically.
It has been a long road,
Drizzt replied with feigned exasperation.
Going to get longer, I'm thinking, said Bruner.
Where is Jarlaxle? Drizzt asked. He turned to Catti Bree and said quietly, We could use his talents, I expect. And the woman was already nodding, clearly thinking along the same lines. Jarlaxle knew the underground way from Luskin to Gontalgrim, and if anyone knew how to deal with a vampire, it would be the mercenary leader.
Luskin, and there I am bound, Braylon answered.
Travel with us, then,
Regis blurted. Many surprised looks came his way. Regis had just invited a drow, one they did not know, into their camp. Rarely would such a gesture prove to be a good idea. Drizzt looked over the newcomer carefully, then turned to Catti Bree, who merely shrugged.
Do, he said to Braylon. The road is dangerous this time of year. We could use another sword.
He looked to the left, to one fallen blade, then to the other, across to the right.
Or two.
They set off soon after, Braylon taking point far out in front on Drizzt's order.
Rumblebelly beat himself a drow elf,
Bruner said when at last Braylon was out of earshot.
That's my pony's name, Regis replied evenly and in all seriousness.
Aye, and what's your own name then?
Asked the laughing dwarf. Regis straightened his shoulders.
Spider,
he said.
Aye, Spider Parathin of Marada Topolino.
Aye, well, there's a mouthful.
Then what of yourself? The halfling asked.
Was known as Reginald Roundshield of the Adbar Roundshields, Bruner answered. Little RR, some called me, but don't think of doing that yourself, or know that I'll put me fist in your eye.
He stomped his heavy boot on the footboard of the wagon and declared,
Bruner's me name and none other. Bruner Battlehammer of Mithril Hall.
And you are Rukia,
Regis said to Catti Bree, who walked her mount casually across the wagon from him and his pony.
Daughter of Niraj and Kavita of Desai, raised on the plains of Netheril.
She had told him the tales, of course, over the long days of the previous winter.
I was,
she corrected.
And now I am who I have always been.
What of yourself, boy? Bruner asked of Wolfgar. Ye ain't telled us who ye been.
Hrolf, son of Alfarin of the tribe of the Elk,
Wolfgar answered.
Born of your own people then, said Bruner. Ah, but ye found a bit of good luck in that.
Regis nodded.
But as he considered the grand road that had brought him back to his friends, as he thought of beautiful Donala Topolino and the grandfather and of Dorigardo and the grinning ponies, he found that he could not agree with Bruner's assessment.
"Hi, Captain Kurth,"
Regis informed his four companions when they noted the red-haired man approaching their camp just outside of Luskin's northern reaches. With Braille and Jankay along, they had made an uneventful journey out of Icewind Dale and through the spine of the world. The five companions had camped outside the city, sending Braille in on his word that he would find and retrieve Jarlaxle.
"Aye, Captain! Then he ain't likely alone," said Bruner. "Ye think the drow rat double-crossed herself?"
Drizzt was shaking his head, the others noted, but the look on his face was perplexed indeed. He knew this man from 20 years previous, but it seemed as if the red-haired fellow hadn't aged a day.
"Well met, and welcome back, Master Paraffin,"
High Captain Kurth greeted, offering a nod to Regis. "Or do you prefer Spider?" Regis tipped his beret.
"Serena sends her regards." "And mine to her, then," Regis replied.
"Beniago?" Drizzt asked, for of course he remembered the name. It had been nearly 2 decades, but to Drizzt, who had slept a magical night in Iruladun, where 18 years had passed on Faerun, it had only been a few 10 days.
"Well met again, Master Doerden," Beniago replied, but in a whisper,
and he glanced around and patted the air with his hand, signaling them to be quiet. "Aye, Captain, now," the man shrugged.
"Outlive your superiors, and the world is yours, yes?"
"Especially for those who are friends of Jarlaxle, I would imagine." Beniago grinned and shrugged.
"Your other friends passed by here a 10 day or so ago," he said.
"Other friends?"
Catti Bree asked.
"And Treri and them strange ones," said Bruner, who had seen an unusual trio indeed, a weirdly twisted tiefling, a boisterous female dwarf, and a gray-skinned human in monk's robes, on the side of Kelvin's cairn on the night he and the others had rejoined Drizzt.
"Bound for?" Drizzt asked, nodding to Regis to confirm Bruner's guess. The man shifted uncomfortably, something both Drizzt and Catti Bree surely caught.
"Who can say? I have come to tell you," he paused and looked around.
"Where are our manners?" Drizzt asked. "A meal and a drink for our guest."
"I already have one set," Wolfgar said from behind them,
and they turned to see him rearranging the large stones they were using as seats to allow for one more. The ease with which Wolfgar hoisted those rocks threw Drizzt back in time, for the man had apparently lost nothing of his uncanny strength in this second incarnation. They gathered around their campfire, and Drizzt called in Guinevar and set her off to make sure they were alone.
"Should I warn her of your associates?" Drizzt asked.
"I came out alone, and dare not remain long," Beniago replied.
He looked around into the darkness, again seeming nervous.
"I only came here because of your mutual friendship with one of my associates."
Drizzt started to ask, but Beniago held up his hand, as if he didn't want the name spoken aloud. Only then did Drizzt begin to fathom the gravity of the meeting.
"The one you seek is not in Luskin,"
Beniago explained, his voice going even quieter.
"I doubt he will ever return, nor should you go in there, nor should you ever mention to anyone that you have traveled with Braille. For his sake, I beg of you."
The surprising request, and the even more surprising humility from one who was High Captain of Ship Kurth, and thus the nearest thing Luskin had to a ruler, set Drizzt back in his seat.
"Eat," Wolfgar offered, holding forth a bowl of stew, but Beniago shook his head and rose up.
"Farewell, wherever you travel."
"We're heading for,"
Bruner started to say, but Beniago cut him short with an emphatic wave. The red-haired man bowed then and disappeared into the night.
"Well, that was interesting," said Bruner when he was gone.
Regis looked at Drizzt.
"Tiago Bayenry," Drizzt remarked, his voice still a whisper, and the halfling nodded and Catty Breeze said,
"Oh,"
and also nodded, apparently catching on.
"What are ye huffing about?"
Bruner demanded.
"I would guess more trouble has followed in Drizzt's wake than the demon fight at Bryn Shander's gate," said Regis.
"Demon fight?" Bruner asked.
Wulfgar gave a laugh.
"Such a simple life I left behind," he lamented.
"So Entreri's been by here, and Jarlaxle is gone and won't return," said Catty Bree. "You said he had a secret way into Gauntlegrim, but that is lost to us, I would expect."
"I got me a map," Bruner said. "We'll get there."
"But not straight away," Drizzt said, looking at the woman who had once been his wife.
"Long saddle,"
Catty Bree agreed.
"Perhaps we should use our new names," Regis suggested, "and find an alias for Drizzt."
"No," Bruner insisted and stamped his boot. "Carried that name too long already."
"Someone's hunting."
"Then let him come," said the dwarf, and he was no longer whispering. "Me name's King Bruner to any who are asking, and King Bruner to any who ain't."
"How much can we trust this Beniago?" Wulfgar asked. And when Drizzt gave him a noncommittal look, the giant barbarian stood up, began re-rolling his bedroll and packing up the wagon. They set off soon after, heading east across the fields. Barely into the journey, Bruner began to sing, a mournful song of loss in a grandeur and era that could not be again, the Delzune song of Gauntlegrim. There was no moon this night and no clouds, and a million stars twinkled in the clear skies above and the gray swirl of a distant galaxy. Clouds in one of the overlapping celestial spheres, Regis named them, striped the sky directly above. It was one of those nights when the heavens seemed to reach down to the earth itself, lifting up the soul and the imagination, much as Drizzt had known in the quiet dark atop Bruner's climb on Kelvin's Cairn. It was a night where the rogue drow felt tiny and yet grand, a part of something ancient, eternal, and as vast as his imagination and as warm as the love among these five friends surrounding him in the wagon, even Guinevar, for he could not bring himself to dismiss her back to her astral home. Indeed, on a night such as this, in a night such as this, it seemed to Drizzt as if Guinevar's home had come to them. Yes, it was good to be home, Drizzt decided. And this, the rolling wagon bouncing across the farmlands east of Luskan, was home. Because home wasn't a place, oh no, but a bond, and one that had never seemed stronger.
Part 2. Crossing Paths and Crossing Swords. I am haunted by the expression on Bruner's face, and by the words of Catty Bree. "The burden you carry blurs your judgment," she told me without reservation. "As you see yourself, you hope to find in others, in orcs and goblins even." She alone said this, but Bruner's expression and wholehearted nod certainly agreed with Catty Bree's assessment. I wanted to argue, but found I could not. I wanted to scream against them both, to tell them that fate is not predetermined by nature, that a reasoning being could escape the determination of heredity, that intellect could overwhelm instinct. I wanted to tell them that I had escaped. And so, in that roundabout, reasoning turned admission,
Caddybree's description of my burden ultimately rang true to me. And so, were I not bound by my own experiences, and the uncertainty that has followed me every step out of Menzo Berenzon, even these many decades later, my expression would likely have matched Brunner's own. Was the Treaty of Garam's Gorge a mistake? To this day, I still do not know, but I find now, in light of this discussion, that my ambiguous stance relies more on the averted suffering to the dwarves and elves and humans of the Silver Marches and less on the benefit to the orcs. For in my heart, I suspect that Brunner is right, and that Caddybree's newfound understanding of orc nature is confirmed by the goings-on in the Silver Marches. The Kingdom of Many Arrows holds as an entity, so Brunner claims, but the peace it promotes is a sham. And perhaps, I must admit, that peace only facilitates the orc raiders and allows them more freedom than they would find if Many Arrows did not exist. Still, with all the revelations and epiphanies, it hurts all of this, and the apparent solution seems a chasm too far for me to jump. Brunner is ready to march to Mithril Hall, rouse the dwarves and raise an army, and with that force wage open war on the Kingdom of Many Arrows. Brunner is determined to begin a war. So determined is he that he will put aside the suffering, the death, the disease, the utter misery that such a conflict will wreak on the land, so that, as he puts it, he might right the wrong he caused that century ago. I cannot start a war. Even if I embraced what Caddybree has claimed, even if I believed that her every word came from the mouth of Mialiki herself, I cannot start a war. I will not, I say, and I fear, nor will I allow Brunner to do so. Even if his words about the nature of orcs are true, and likely they are, then the current situation still, in my view, remains better than the open conflict he so desires. Perhaps I am bound to caution because of my burden of personal experience, but Brunner is bound by guilt to try to correct what he sees as his chance at redemption. Is that any less a burden? Likely it is more so. He will run headlong into misery for himself, his legacy, and for all the goodly folk of the Silver Marches. That is my fear, and as such, as a friend, I must stop him if I can. I can only wince at the possibilities illuminated by this course, for I have never seen Brunner more determined, more sure of his steps. So much so that should I try to dissuade him, I fear we might come to blows. As indeed I fear my road back to Mithril Hall. My last visit was not pleasant, and not one I often consider, for it pains me to realize that I, a ranger, have worked openly against dwarves and elves for the sake of orcs, for the sake of the peace, I tell myself. But in the end, that dodge can only hold true if Caddybree's admonition, if Mialiki's claim is not true. If orcs are not to be counted among the reasoning beings born of a choice in their road, then I will follow Brunner to Mithril Hall. If the orc raiders are as prevalent as Brunner insists, then I am sure I will find good use for my blades, and likely at Brunner's side, vigilant hunters striking without hesitation or guilt. But I will not start a war. That chasm is too wide. Am I wrong, then, in hoping that the decision is taken from us before we ever arrive? In hoping that the Kingdom of Many Arrows proves Caddybree's point in no uncertain terms? Where's the baby's room, I hear her again, often in my thoughts, in that dwarvish brogue of old, and with the ferocity befitting a daughter of King Brunner Battlehammer. And though Caddybree carried this accent for many years, and can fight as well as any, this time her cheer rang discordantly, painfully in my ears. What of Nozheim, then? The goblin I once knew, who seemed a decent sort, undeserving of his harsh fate. Or am I really saying? What then of Drizzt? I want to deny the message of Mele. Once I claimed the goddess as that which was in my heart, a name for what I knew to be true and right. And now I want to deny it, desperately so, and yet I cannot. Perhaps it is the harsh truth of Faerûn that goblin kin and evil giant kind are just evil, by nature and not nurture. And likely my perception of this truth has been distorted by my own determined escape from the seemingly inevitable path I was born to follow, and perhaps distorted in dangerous ways. On a very basic level, this message wounds me, and that wound is the burden. Is there, in this instant, no place for optimism, and an insistence that there is good to be found? Does that outlook, the guiding philosophy of my existence, simply have no place in the darkness of an orc's heart? Can I start a war? I walk this road tentatively, but also eagerly, for I am filled with conflict. I wish to know. I must know. I am afraid to know. Alas, so much has changed, but so much remains the same. The spell plague is gone, yet trouble seems ever to be brewing in our wake. Yet we walk a road into deeper darkness, into Gontalgrim for the sake of a lost friend, and then, if we arrive, into the midst of a greater storm. For all of that, have I ever been happier? Drizzt Do'Urden. Chapter 9. When the Sun Went Down.
You shouldn't have stopped me,
Dahlia said with an accompanying hiss when Entreri walked back into the room they shared in Port Last, a high room in the inn called Stonecutter's Solace, tucked up against the eastern cliffs of the sheltered city. Dahlia sat at the room's lone window, looking west, to the docks and the ocean of the reclaimed city. Reclaimed in no small part because of the actions of this very group of adventurers. The sun sat low on the horizon before her, ready to surrender to the twilight.
That again?
Entreri asked with a snort. He was returning from a late supper with the other three of their party. A meal in which the pouting Dahlia had refused to partake. Dahlia swiveled around in her seat to regard him, her face scrunching with that unrelenting anger. She wore her hair in the top braid again, something she had not done in some time, and her magical blue facial woad seemed particularly angry to Entreri this evening, somewhat resembling a hunting cat, and she turned and tilted her head obstinately. At least, that was the impression it gave to him.
Do you think he is following us?
She asked. No. In truth, the assassin had no idea whether Drizzt had decided to follow them out of Icewind Dale, nor was he overly concerned in any case, at least not for the reason Dahlia was clearly concerned. Likely Drizzt had remained in Icewind Dale, as he had indicated he would. He was probably licking his wounds and looking for some way to redeem his reputation among the folk of Ten Towns, Entreri figured, for the assassin had seen the pain on Drizzt's face when they had been denied entry to Bryn Shander. Drizzt should have come with them, Entreri believed, although Dahlia had made that road far more difficult. Or perhaps Entreri was simply considering his own preferences. To have the capable and steady drow warrior at his side. That realization surprised him more than a little.
He will seek revenge, Dahlia insisted. You should not have stopped me.
Entreri laughed at her.
He deserved to die, Dahlia spat, and she leaped out of her seat and stormed across the room to stand before the man.
We were the ones who betrayed him, remember? And Trary came back with a snicker. And Drizzt forgave and never once confronted me.
He dismissed me,
Dahlia interrupted, as if that explained everything regarding her outright attack on the drow. She poked her finger into Entreri's chest as she spoke, which brought another amused smile from the man. So Dahlia slapped him across the face. But he intercepted, catching her by the wrist and turning her arm down and around with a painful jerk.
I am not Drizzt O'Erden, he assured her evenly. If you attack me, I will fight back.
We have battled before, Dahlia reminded him.
Yes. But then I didn't understand your strange weapon, the assassin replied, using that voice that had chilled the blood of so many victims over the decades, usually right before his blades had drained that same blood. I know your style and tricks now. If you attack me, have no doubt I will kill you.
He let go of her wrist, shoving the arm aside, and Dahlia fell back a step, staring at him with an expression caught somewhere between outrage and intrigue. Behind her, through the window, the sun disappeared, the long shadows giving way to dusk.
Is that what you want? Entreri reasoned. Isn't that what you've always wanted?
Dahlia straightened and squared her shoulders, but couldn't seem to find a response.
Because you are a coward? Entreri asked.
The woman's hands reflexively moved toward her flail, the pair set in a belt loop on her left hip. Artemis and Entreri smiled again, and Dahlia stopped short of grabbing them.
To what end, Dahlia?
He asked quietly.
You have your son back, and he forgives you, even if you cannot find the strength to forgive yourself. How long will you continue hating what you see in the mirror?
You know nothing of it.
I know that you went after Drizzt because he rejected you, Entreri answered. I also know your game.
She tilted her head in curiosity, prompting him to elaborate.
To find a lover who will confirm what you hate about yourself,
Entreri obliged.
And to find one who will, when you confront him, be strong enough to finally grant you peace. Well, take heart, elf, for here I stand.
Dahlia fell back a step, staring at Entreri and seemingly at a loss.
We are done. Here and now,
Entreri announced.
I will sail from this place without you.
Dahlia's expression went blank, and she mouthed no, though she couldn't seem to find the breath to actually speak the word, as she shook her head slowly in denial.
So draw your weapons as you will,
Entreri said, and he made sure he did so rather flippantly.
I long ago lost count of those I've killed.
One more shan't matter.
Dahlia continued to shake her head, and it seemed to Entreri that she might simply melt then and there before him.
Tears gathered in her eyes, one rolling down her cheek. Her lips moved as if she were trying to find something to say to him, some denial. What he didn't see, to his great satisfaction, was anger.
Please,
she finally managed to say. Entreri laughed callously and turned for the door. He did so while moving his hands close to his weapons, fully expecting an attack. And indeed, Dahlia came after him, but not with her weapon, throwing herself at him plaintively, crying out for him not to leave. He turned and caught her charge and twisted around as they moved for the door so that he pushed her up against it and not the other way around.
Please,
she said, trembling, and Entreri realized that he was the only thing holding her up.
I grew tired of hearing of Drizzt, he said to her, and she was nodding with every word,
you truly believe that I did you no favor in ending your fight on the mountain, then tell me now. It took Dahlia a moment, and then she lowered her eyes and slowly shook her head. And Treri pushed up against her, pinning her tightly to the closed door, his face a finger's breadth from hers. Do you want me to lead you back to him, that together we can finish what you started? He asked. Would it please you to kill Drizdo Urden? Dahlia's expression showed her shock at the blunt question. Say the word, he teased. No, she said, but calmly. She shook her head again, but with conviction now, as she straightened against the door. No. And Treri smiled once more, and when she pressed in closer to kiss him, he did not resist. Artemis and Treri understood the power and significance of Dahlia's epiphany, even though it was something that Dahlia did not yet fully comprehend. It took me many years to be able to look into a mirror honestly, he said quietly, pulling back from her just a bit. And even still, shadows lurk. His sentence was cut short by a sudden explosion that shook Stonecutter's solace to its foundation, threw Entreri up against Dahlia, and jolted both of them hard into the door. Entreri jumped back and pulled Dahlia around behind him. He threw the door open and charged into the hall, cutting left for the stairway, drawing his weapons as he went. The corridor ran 20 feet before turning back to the right around the corner at the top of the stairs. The building rocked again, shaking under a tremendous blast, and a burst of flames exploded up from the stairs and into Entreri's corridor, rolling and dissipating, licking the walls to blackness. Beneath that gout came Afafrenfir, rolling low along the floor, tucked fully under his heavy robes. He came up as the flames disappeared and glanced to Entreri. "Drow," he cried, "many, run!" Darkness engulfed him, blacking out the end of the corridor. Entreri took a step the monk's way before falling back in surprise at a thunderous retort from the end of the hall. A lightning bolt, he knew, burned into the magical darkness. The assassin skidded and turned around, crashing into Dahlia as she exited the room and shoving her back in before him. He swung the door closed and kept running across the room to the small window. "Drow!" he yelled back at Dahlia, who was repeatedly screaming, "What? What? We've got to get out of here." "Efren," she cried, and Treri kicked the window out. "He left for a walk with the dwarf when I returned to you," he said. "Be quick!" And out he went, catching hold on the top border of the glass, then standing atop the pane. Stonecutter's solace was set up against the eastern cliff wall of the valley city of Port Last, up high on a foundation of stone. The buildings before it were also below it, and when Entreri looked out this window, he could see over the rooftops of the lesser structures to the west. Even in the dim light of dusk, Entreri saw that the fighting wasn't confined to Stonecutter's solace. Down the street, a man staggered out of a building and fell face down in the road. On the porch below, patrons of the inn scrambled and ran, or tried to, for Afafrenfir's call had indeed been accurate, and murderous dark elves caught them and cut them down. A bit farther along, Entreri noted another enemy, a bigger enemy, half drow, half spider. He had spent years in Menzo Baranzon. He knew the power and sheer evil of the abomination known as a drider. He shook his head and finger-crawled away along the side of the building, some 10 feet from the window. He turned back to call to Dahlia and motioned for her to follow, then continued on a bit more and pushed himself out from the wall in a great leap, landing lightly atop the roof of the building just below Stonecutter's solace. He turned back for Dahlia, thinking to catch her if her leap brought her in short. And he just shook his head when he realized that the dangerous elf woman wasn't following him at all. She came flying out of the window, literally, her magical cloak transforming her into a giant raven. She swept out of the window and circled tightly, climbing fast to land on the inn's roof. And Treri glanced down. The building was burning, and the sounds from the common room on the first floor told him that the fight was on in full. Bright, blinding light filled all the windows in a sudden and thunderous flash, and splinters of wood went flying off the far side of the building, blown apart by a powerful stroke of some lightning-like magic. And out came a pair of men, staggering, jerking wildly, hair flying crazily. A drow leaped out behind them, his shield and sword seeming like the essence of the stars themselves, translucent, but spotted with bits of stones that sparkled like diamond lights in a night sky. The drow struck once, twice, and both men tumbled down, writhing and dying. It occurred to Artemis and Trary that he had seen this drow before, though not outfitted so marvelously, surely. Still watching the movements, watching the deference played toward this one by the other dark elves spilling out behind him, brought a name to Entreri's lips, one from a dark place in a dark time.
Tiago Beenri, he shook his head. Lovely.
Whoa now! Ambergris said, staggering and trying to hold her balance as the whole street reverberated with a shock of rolling thunder. She grabbed onto Efren for support and caught his dead arm, which was swaying wildly behind his back. Dwarf, he managed to call out before tumbling over backward. Eh, no, Ambergris answered, standing over him, one hand reaching down to help him. No, dwarf? A shaken and unsettled Efren reached up for the dwarf's offered hand, but he paused, noting Amber's face. He followed her gaze across the lane to the front of a building, and more important, to the gigantic arachnoid creature standing in front of the building. Its drow face smiling, the beast lifted a huge spear and let fly. The throw came in high above Amber's head, but that was the design, for the spear trailed a net that opened behind it. Bah! Ambergris cried, grabbing her mace off her back and sweeping it across, right to left as she dived out to the right. Skullcrusher's bulbous head hit the side of the net and drove it across, and the dwarf rolled free. She called out for Efren, though, certain that her companion was under the net, and when she scrambled around, she managed to glance that way to confirm that, yes indeed, the twisted young tiefling crouched in the road, covered by the heavy cords of the drider net. "Bah, ye dog!" the dwarf roared and started forward as the drider lifted another spear and charged off the porch. But another form came first, rushing around the skittering spider legs, out of the spider's twilight shadow, and Ambergris howled and batted her mace back and forth desperately, in full retreat as she parried the sudden strikes of drow swords. "Get out, boy! Oh, run!" she managed to cry out, staggering backward, trying to find some measure of a defensive posture against the overwhelming assault by the drow warrior. A task made much easier a heartbeat later, when a line of black fire swept between Ambergris and the drow, and to the dwarf's great relief, the hot side of the dark fire licked cruelly at her opponent. She saw the drow sprinting away, slapping at flames, and turned to thank and hopefully support Efren, but stopped before she had taken a step that way. Where the warlock had been was now a roiling cloud of gooey black smoke, rolling over and popping like bubbling mud, and spreading, it seemed, like a hungry black ooze. Not knowing what to make of it, Ambergris retreated across the street, running for the shelter of the house behind. She reached the door and almost got through when a second drider suddenly appeared, meeting her in the doorway with a swing of a heavy cudgel that rattled off the side of Amber's head, sending her staggering backward yet again to smash through a hitching rail and stagger hard into a stack of water barrels, sending them and the stunned dwarf tumbling. Pressed flat against the wooden floor in the magical darkness, his robes tight around him, Afafrenfir felt the burning and shocking power of the lightning bolt. He heard the wall splintering above him and had to hope that it was broken apart enough for him to push through. But he couldn't check it, he knew instinctively, and he wasn't surprised when he found that he was not alone in the darkness. These were dark elves, after all, who relished the blackness. The monk came up fast, and on instinct even leaped as he rose, and he felt the cut of a sword beneath him as expected, the drow figuring to finish what the fireball and lightning bolt had started.
Half a friend fear landed lightly and struck out with his hands left and right and fell into a rhythm, feeling the movements around him, anticipating the attacks. An outturned downward slap moved a cutting sword aside. An uplifted leg bent at the knee, starting in close and sweeping out wide, took a second sword with it, and as he moved that leg, Afa Frenfear planted his foot firmly and bowled ahead. His heavy right punch connected squarely, and he felt the lighter drow flying away and heard the dark elf tumbling down the stairs. But the replacement was there almost instantly, and the fact that this newcomer had so easily avoided the flying swordsman told the monk that the area of darkness was very limited, likely just a stride or so. Afa Frenfear rushed to the right along the corridor. Hope rekindled when he came out of the darkness, as he had suspected, only two quick strides to the right. And that hope fell away when he realized that he was alone, that Entrary and Dahlia were gone, and hope plummeted from a high cliff face when a shining sword chased him out of the darkness and caught up to him, under his late block, to stab him deeply in the side. He lurched and stumbled toward the door of Entrary's room. Then he stopped and spun around, his left arm leading and rising, lifting the pursuing drow's sword. Afa Frenfear kicked his foot up straight between himself and the dark elf, as if he meant to stomp it down straight ahead, and indeed, the drow's second blade angled in to defeat such an attack. But Afa Frenfear's leg swept out to the side and down instead, away from the blade, and the monk stepped in behind the feigned kick and leaned forward over his feet to drive his open hand into the drow's chin, staggering the swordsman back into the darkness. Afa Frenfear kept going forward with a jump and somersault, and as he came over, he double-kicked straight ahead, into the darkness and into the drow. The monk felt the bite of a sword on one leg, but it was not a substantial hit, and certainly nothing to compare with the weight of his own blows. He landed hard, but came up suddenly and started for the door. He winced with every stride, not for his leg, but for the first wound in his side, one much worse than he had initially realized, it seemed. By the time he pushed through the door, he was wheezing and fighting for breath, with one hand against his torn side, trying to quell the bleeding. Afa Frenfear stumbled to the broken window, where Entrary and Dahlia had made their escape. He looked out of the street, now with fighting visible in many locations. Stonecutter Solace shook again with a tremendous explosion, one that put the monk down to the floor. He knew the drow were coming. He certainly hadn't killed either of his last two foes. Now fighting for every clawing inch, Afa Frenfear pulled himself back up and squeezed out of the window. He had to climb for the roof, he knew, his fingers settling on the top board of the frame. With great effort, the bleeding monk pulled himself to his feet on the sill. He picked his next handhold, then grimaced as he got slugged in the gut. No, not punched, he realized, looking down to see the hand crossbow bolt sticking in his midsection. Another joined it. Afa Frenfear knew about drow poison, of course, but that didn't trouble him nearly as much as knowing that there were a pair of dark elves, at least, coming into the room. He let go of the top board and stepped off the sill. From across the rooftop of the building before and below Stonecutter's Solace, Artemis Entrary noted Afa Frenfear's movements. Recognizing that the monk appeared in need of help, Entrary started to wave out to Dahlia, who stood atop the inn's roof as an elf woman once more. She looked down over the street. He tried to get her attention, but Dahlia seemed not to notice, her gaze set farther along to the west, down the road and the hill from the inn. Entrary brought his fingers to his lips, thinking to blow a sharp whistle to gain her attention. But before he could, Afa Frenfear simply stepped away and dropped from the ledge. The shocked Entrary understood a moment later when a dark elf appeared at the window. Down plummeted the monk, but his hands and feet worked furiously along the side of the building, catching holds and slowing his fall somewhat. But Afa Frenfear was surely in a weakened state, Entrary could see, and he hit the ground hard, his legs buckling under him as he rolled away from the burning building. And not far from him stood the drow with the sword and shield, the one Entrary thought he recognized as Tiago Beenri. A drow noble.
Once more, Entreri turned to the rooftop to call to Dahlia, and he was relieved to see her become a giant raven again, moving to the edge and springing off into the darkening night. He thought she must be going to Afafrenfir's rescue, but could only shake his head as Dahlia swooped out and away from the building, flying right past Entreri's perch and farther on down the street. Hardly thinking of the movement, realizing only that he was the monk's only chance at survival, Artemis Entreri sprinted across the roof. Tiago Bayenri had noticed the fallen monk, who was then struggling to stand back up, shaky on his legs and lurching to the side, his hand tight there, obviously against a wound. Tiago would have him dead before he ever readied a defense. Weapons in hand, Entreri had leaped down to the ground and sprinted to Afafrenfir before he could even consider the seemingly suicidal move. He went by the monk and met the charge of Tiago, his sword blocked by that translucent, star-filled shield, his jeweled dagger ably taking the drow's strange sword aside. In his head, the assassin spat curses at Drizdo Urten. Drizzt had done this to him, he knew. All those acts and talks of nobility and community and friendship, all of that indeed, had put Artemis Entreri into battle with a drow noble, superbly armed and with many allies all around. And all for the sake of a wounded friend. "How has it come to this?" the assassin asked with a helpless laugh. A golden, translucent shield appeared at the front of the bubbling ooze of Efren's magical smoke, and not a heartbeat too soon, for the huge drider let fly another spear, this one aimed lower, to pierce the heart of the cloud and the heart of the warlock who had just created the cloud. The spear hit the shield and deflected wide, spinning and shaking, but still deadly, as one unfortunate citizen, fleeing the battle up the road at the inn, found out. The huge missile caught him in the side, lifted him from the ground, and threw him back across the street, not far from where Ambergris shakily tried to rise. The man groaned and rolled, grabbing at the spear as if hoping to tug its barbed head free. He was dead before he closed his hands. The bubbling ooze around Efren melted away, and melted with it was the heavy net, the thick coils, those that remained at all reduced to twisted and charred lines of unconnected twine. The young warlock stood up, leaned his bone staff against his shoulder, and dusted himself off, his expression aptly reflecting that he was more piqued than scared as he matched stares with the huge drider. And though Efren may have seemed a tiny thing indeed, standing before a creature as large and imposing as this particular drider, who now produced a trident that was longer than Efren was tall, the twisted warlock was not the least bit intimidated by the half-spider, half-drow abomination. No, he was just angry. He swept his bone staff in front of him, releasing a wave of bolts of black energy, weaving around as they flew across the way to turn unerringly, burning into the drider. As the creature recoiled, stung but hardly defeated, Efren glanced back for Ambergris. He saw her, but she wasn't about to be much use to him, obviously. She had risen by then, and had her large mace in hand, but faced an enemy akin to his own, although a smaller abomination than this one, and, like the dwarf, female. Efren noted another possibility, though, and he held forth his staff, the eye on its small skull head flaring with the power of the negative plane. A line of red energy reached out from the weapon for the man lying dead at the end of the drider's spear. Efren spun back and stamped his staff on the ground, and the area between him and the closing male drider began to bubble and boil, and octopus-like tentacles erupted from the morass, writhing and reaching for the arachnoid creature. Just a few moments later, the newly created zombie shuffled by Efren, the long spear dragging at its side, and bore down on the drider, walking right through the black tentacles where the drider did not dare. "Tricks will not save you," the drider cried, ending with a grunt as Efren hit it with stinging black fire. The zombie wandered through, lifting its arms to rake at the drider. The drider impaled it with a single thrust of his huge trident and easily lifted the undead thing high into the air, tossing it far over his shoulder in a movement that reminded Efren of a farmer throwing hay. He nodded his admiration to the beast, then moved fast to his right as the Drider skittered right, determined to keep the writhing tentacles between them. Distance favored him, Ephraim knew, and he threw another wave of black energy missiles, weaving through the tentacles and stinging the mighty Drider yet again.
"How many have you got, trickster?"
the beast howled.
"Forevermore," Ephraim answered, and simply to prove his point, he sent forth another wave.
But the creature smiled through its grimaces, its expression so confident as to be more than a little unnerving. Ephraim glanced to the left to see Ambergris apparently holding her own on the porch of the building. As he continued moving to his right, the twisted warlock glanced over his shoulder. A large black bird glided down toward him. His mother, he knew, but whatever comfort he might take in that powerful reinforcement was quickly lost. For the Drider had allies as well, a group of dark elves standing in concentric circles, centered by one who served as the hub of a peculiar spider's web of blue-sparking electrical energy.
"Fly away," the young warlock yelled to his mother, just as she came down beside him, and just as the drow flung the lightning web, spinning, turning, and sparkling. Dahlia came back to her elf form. The lightning net fell over the mother and son. Ephraim melted away.
Amber finally found her footing. She shook her head to clear the dizziness and met the Drider's next swing with Skull Crusher, mace and cudgel connecting with teeth-shattering force. The dwarf was more than ready to play that game, though, even against this larger opponent. She began to mouth the words to a spell, to fill her muscles with the strength of Clangadin, but then came the explosions, the flashes, the trembling ground, violently shaking as the lightning net landed over Dahlia, who stood just a few strides from Ambergris. The dwarf staggered, but the Drider, so balanced on 8 spidery legs, did not. Cudgel and mace met again with crushing force. The shock wave of magical thunder continued. The ground rolled. Ambergris was on her back then, her spell driven from her lips, her mace flown from her hand, the Drider standing over her. The Drider's heavy cudgel descended. The first exchanges seemed more a dance than a battle, with Entreri and Tiago circling, each offering weak thrusts that were easily blocked or parried.
"Where is he?"
Tiago asked, and he turned back to his right, putting the now-burning stonecutter Solace behind him. Entreri moved fast to intercept, seeing that the drow was creating an open line for the fallen monk.
"Any time you wish to join in would be welcomed," Entreri said to his companion.
Afafrenfir groaned and managed to stand, but barely, for one leg would not hold his weight, and the side of his robe was soaked in blood. A quick glance at the man had Entreri realizing that he had been foolish indeed to leap down from the rooftop to come to Afafrenfir's aid. This one, he believed, wasn't about to survive the wounds he already bore. The assassin went at Tiago in his frustration, sword leading in and up, and he spun behind it in a sudden reverse to send his dagger thrusting forward. But Tiago not only met the sword with his own wondrous blade and got his shield in line with the dagger, he did so while resetting his feet. Before Entreri had even completed the maneuver, Tiago came forward in a rush, his shield sweeping out before him, but turned then so that its edge could cut across to take Entreri out at the legs. Entreri barely retreated in time, and Tiago continued forward, sword chopping, shield cutting back the other way, then back again, with the sword quickly following in a dizzying display. The assassin had nearly been caught off his guard with the sheer ferocity, balance, and coordination of the attack. This was a Bayenri noble, he reminded himself, and he knew well what that likely meant. Entreri would be at his best here, or he would surely be dead. He matched Tiago's assault with a fast riposte, then drove forward with 3 sudden thrusts, each forcing the drow farther from Afafrenfir and more to the middle of the lane.
"Monk!" Entreri called, and he winced as dark elves began to arrive, coming from the windows and door and floating down from the higher windows of the burning building. "Run!"
In response, Afafrenfear took a step, nearly tumbling as his weight came upon his broken leg. He grimaced and fought through it, though, stumbling along for another few steps. A globe of darkness engulfed him. A hail of javelins swarmed into the globe. There came a grunt and the thud of the man falling to the ground, and Entreri noted his hand protruding from the edge of the darkness, fingers trembling and moving as if they were trying to grasp at life itself. Then stillness. So it was over, Entreri realized. His gallant idiocy sure to leave them both dead on the street. He managed a glance behind him, down the lane toward the lower city, and caught sight of Dahlia in crow form touching down beside Efren, and Amber battling a horrid drider off to the side, and a spinning web of lightning descending right behind Dahlia. The flashes and reverberations of that lightning net shook the ground all around this section of Port Last. People were running, scrambling, tumbling as the ground moved under their feet. Entreri held his balance, and even used the tremor to go at Tiago once more, hoping to at least take this miserable drow noble down before the other dark elves overwhelmed him. But Tiago, with equal balance, was ready for the charge, and Entreri's slashing sword met a spiraling, widening shield, a magical shield expanding right before Entreri's eyes. Tiago dared to roll around, even putting his back to Entreri for a brief instant. His back! Entreri saw the opening. His opponent had underestimated him. He went for the target, or tried to, but found to his horror that his sword was stuck fast to Tiago's shield, as surely as if he had slashed it into the side of a thick spider web. Tiago came around, turning that shield, tugging hard and nearly taking the sword from Entreri's hand. Only the assassin's great speed and balance allowed him to twist and turn enough to hold on desperately as the drow's sword stabbed for him. Only a last-instant parry by his jeweled dagger turned that blade from his face, and only enough so that blade still nicked his ear as it passed. Entreri felt the sting of that hit and the added sting of drow poison. And then the ground rolled under him suddenly, like an ocean wave, and he and Tiago were lifted into the air, deafened by a thunderstroke and blinded by a flash so brilliant that it stole the night. Chapter 10. Every day, every experience, every thrill. "Carutelli," Penelope Harple said with great enthusiasm and a loud clap of her hands when the five companions, led by Catty Bree, were escorted into her audience chamber.
"Eh?"
Brunner asked. But Catty Bree was simply smiling in response at the affectionate nickname, one Catty Bree had earned in her initial meeting with Penelope a couple of years earlier. When asked her name in that first meeting, Catty Bree had nearly blurted the truth, then tried to change it with the name she had been given by her Bedine parents, and finally had settled on her alias, that of poor Deli Curti. She moved swiftly across the room, catching Penelope, her mentor, in a great hug.
"I told you I would return," she said. "To tell me the truth of your tale, so you promised," Penelope replied as they broke the embrace.
The older woman looked past Catty Bree to her companions, and her expression turned to one of curiosity when her gaze settled on the dark elf.
"Drizzto Erden?" she asked. "Truly?"
The drow bowed. "Well met, Lady Penelope," he said.
"Truly indeed,"
said an old man as he came in the door. He walked around Drizzt, nodded, and smiled to Catty Bree, then clapped the drow on the shoulder. "Kipper Harple," Drizzt said, nodding. He didn't really remember the man all that well, but the name was fresh in his thoughts, given Catty Bree's tutelage of the current state of the Ivy Mansion as the group had neared the place.
"I was a young man when last you came through Long Saddle," Kipper said.
"Aye, was half a century ago when last we seen ye,"
answered Brunner, moving up beside Drizzt and offering his hand to Kipper. The old man looked at him curiously.
"Half a century?" he asked, staring doubtfully at the young dwarf, who could not be half that age.
"I was older then," Brunner said with a laugh.
"I was older still," Wolfgar said. "In human years." Regis snorted and waved his hand dismissively at the other two.
"I was dead,"
he exclaimed. Kipper turned to Penelope, but she wore a perplexed expression to match that of the old mage.
"I told you I had a tale to tell," Caddy Bree said to her.